Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. Sometimes the books that arrive in my mailbox from publishers surprise me. At first glance, I didn't think the book Clay, A Human History by Jennifer Lucy Allen would interest me. I'm not somebody who works in the artisan's realm of pottery and ceramics, though I have known and admired many who have, including the students I used to have at Corning High School. They always seemed to love ceramics classes with Mrs. Beardsley and Ms. Atkinson. After perusing a few pages and diving into the book by our guest, I found that I was fascinated thinking about how these water-formed minerals we call clays have impacted and literally shaped the human experience from the very beginning. For those of you who are experienced in this realm, I think you'd find it a great read. And for those of you more like me, I hope you'll stick around to find out more. Our guest is British journalist and broadcaster Jennifer Lucy Allen. She has a PhD in, of all things, foghorns. And we'll find out a bit about that, too. But for sure, we want to discuss her new book, Clay, A Human History. Jennifer, welcome to Blue Dot.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into your wonderful book about clay, I noticed you have a PhD in a very interesting subject.
Yes, I have. I think I'm usually pretty confident that I've got the most useless PhD in the room, whatever room I'm in, because I have a PhD in foghorns, which became my first book.
Well, if your room's in a lighthouse or, you know, on the coast, it might be actually quite useful. What got you into being that interested in foghorns?
Well, my background is as a music journalist. So, mm-hmm. And I've kind of always done writing and journalism in various forms. And I worked as online editor at a long-running kind of avant-garde experimental music magazine called The Wire. And while I was there, I was reviewing an album by somebody that had this, I think it's a French horn on it, and I was trying to describe it. You know, you do these like, you know, similes, metaphors a lot in music journalism, and was like, oh, that sounds like a foghorn, because it had these kind of seascape kind of sounds in it as well. And then I was being a really good journalist that day and went to fact check myself and was like, actually, what does a foghorn sound like? Because I grew up in a landlocked part of the UK, really, in the northwest, just outside Manchester. So I didn't really know what I was like, oh, I don't know what a foghorn sounds like. And I just completely lost myself in an internet wormhole. You know, at the time I was like, and I and still am really interested in the fringes of music and sound and what's possible and the radical things people are doing with their instruments and things like that. And this felt like another example or an extension of that. I just found myself asking, whose idea was this? You know, you look at that, the foghorn, and we recognize it as this sort of trope in film and TV and soundtracks and things like that. It kind of has this emotional resonance that we all respond to, you know?
Yeah, that distinctive sound.
Yeah, you know, and it's like, it's such a part of some city's identity, like San Francisco, yeah. For example.
Oh, yeah.
But then actually, if you sort of take a step back from your sort of attachment to it or understanding of it in that way, then you're like, hang on, this is a massive, really loud instrument on a really nice or really rough coastline. Like, that's such a sort of intrusive or dramatic or actually kind of weird thing to do. So I started asking questions like, whose idea was this? Why do they sound like they do? Who invented them? Do they actually work? And I just ended up in this, you know, absolute wormhole. And then I kind of wanted it spiraled out of control. And a person that I work with now told me about some PhD funding that was about interdisciplinary projects that were all kind of a bit off the map in arts and humanities. And I got funding through this kind of consortium to do all of that historical research.
Yeah, I could see where that would be. That would be quite fascinating. Okay, let's talk about clay. What got you interested in pursuing a book that looks at the human history of clay, as it's called, how clay is just interwoven through humanity from its very origins to now? What got you interested in this story?
So while I was doing that foghorn research and writing, I moved out from London to live on the coast of the Thames out in Essex, where a lot of the big ships came through. But I didn't really know that many people there, and I had my head in all these kind of books and archives and sort of reports and all of this material. And I really needed to get out in the evenings and do something social, do something with my hands. I did an art qualification at high school, but like my high school didn't have very much money, and we didn't really have any materials to speak of. So I never made a pot when I was younger. Never touched any clay. So then I found this pottery class, a really magical place on the edge of the Thames, in a shipping container in a marina. So this interesting hybrid of these two subjects coming together. And this woman called Madeline, who had this very sort of Socratic way of teaching. She didn't do courses. She would help you bring into the world the thing that you wanted to make. And I remember walking in there, and it's, at the end of this kind of dark marina that's a functioning marina. And right at the end, there was this shipping container with, these windows just with this golden glow all steamed up. And I remember walking in the door and just being like, what is this place? And there's a bunch of people all making different things. And I just remember. And she sort of sat me down, and I was like, I've never touched any clay before. I want to come to these open sessions. And she was like, what do you want to make? And I was like, I think I want to make something like this, but I don't know what the techniques are. And she was like, okay, sit down. I'm going to show you how to pinch a pot. And I just remember being taken with the material from then. There was something so, I don't know, there's a feeling that I get when I find a new, genre of music that I love, or with the foghorns, when I went online, like this total, attention sink. I become very obsessive, and I want to know more. And I felt that with that material. And so I started doing what I always do, which is like, where's the books on this? What can I read? How can I learn some more? What is this material? What's happened to it? Where are the like interesting or esoteric stories for me to read about? And there's loads of amazing books about clay and ceramics. There's a huge wealth of material on porcelain. There's a lot of instructional books, a lot of beautiful coffee table books. But as sort of my time in the studio went on, I was sort of going through all these and not really finding the one that I wanted. I wanted this book that was like this rush of excitement of all of these different threads, because I was sort of finding, oh, there's this over there, and there's that over there, and actually there's that over there as well. And, feeling really, really excited, like a kid in a sweet shop. And I couldn't find this kind of modern nonfiction that really had that thing that was how I was feeling swept up in the material. But I was such a beginner then, I've been doing ceramics for, I guess, 10 years at this point. So it took me about, I don't know, 7 years to convince myself to write the book, of reading and research and just being generally interested in my spare time. And I didn't feel like I had the permission to write it. And then it was doing this project called Ecstatic Material. I was producing it with a friend, and it was with an amazing artist that I love called Keith Harrison, who does a lot to do with ceramic processes in his art. Like, the joke is he's always accidentally making these bombs in art galleries. And he said to me, while we were kind of cleaning up this ridiculous show that we put on, he was like, are you going to do that book? And I was like, I can't do it. I don't know anything about this. And he said, just because you don't know anything doesn't mean you haven't got something to say about it. And then, I realized I kind of did know something by then. I'd done this research. I was starting to work with ceramicists in various ways. I'd done 10 years of my own working with Madeline. And she'd, because of the way she teaches, I'd picked up lots of different techniques. I'd never settled on the wheel, for example. And so that was really where it started. And then, it takes a long time for a book to come together. So there's another few years on top of that. And the book really, I wanted it to have that many-pronged, kind of exciting, almost like chaotic feel to it. The feeling that there's an infinity of stories here to choose from.
That's a good way of putting it, because there's just so many things that I ran across in this book that I won't have time to ask you about. I wrote down a few that, you know, just kind of really piqued my interest. But it's interesting you mentioning your high school and, you know, having a kind of limited exposure to the arts there. And it makes me think that I was very fortunate. I was a high school teacher for many years at Corning Union High School here in Northern California. And these two amazing art teachers, ceramics teachers, Mindy Beardsley and Karen Atkinson.
Wow.
And just phenomenal teachers. And the stuff that they would get their students to do, and how literally fired up they were to do their work. And also that it wasn't just about, hey, you know, make this piece of art. It was about learning about the history of ceramics and, you know, taking it to much deeper levels. It was just astonishing when I think back on it. I'm like, wow, those kids, you know, that community was very lucky to have those teachers.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah, I'm jealous.
Can you walk us through some of the basics for those of us like myself who've really never done any ceramics work? I know from talking to a friend, producer Matt Fidler's wife, Jill, she kind of gave me a little 101 about, you know, pottery and ceramics. But could you kind of walk us through the techniques you learn as a beginner, like, you know, just by hand? What are some of the basics that people have been doing for millennia?
Yeah, so I think I mentioned this before, that the first thing that most people get taught when they first begin with clay, whether they're an adult or a child, is how to make a pinch pot. And a pinch pot is this kind of very fundamental prehistoric gesture, really. So what you would do is you kind of have a, I guess, like a fist-sized ball of clay, like the size of a baseball or a tennis ball or something like that. And if you've got that, you kind of sink your thumb into the middle. And that gesture, that kind of, you've got this hollow there. And even in that really simple gesture, you have, you know, something that will hold a sip of water. It's not fired. If you leave the water in there, it'll melt it, I guess, or it kind of gets soaked in and make the clay more squidgy. But you have something that will hold water there. And that is so important to our existence as humans. The space that is the clay then between your thumb and your forefingers that are on the outside of the pot, that's the walls of your pot. So you kind of pinch them round and round just a tiny little bit. Round and round, you move it, you pinch it, you move it, you pinch it. And so you open up that hollow in the middle. And that gesture is like very repetitive, but it also is very individual. You know, we all have different hands. We all do it differently. You might have done it loads before. You might have never done it before. So you're kind of clumsy. But it's got a kind of real tactility in it. And at that moment, you know, you've done these kind of two processes. You've sunk your thumb into that clay, and then you've kind of pinched out that hollow to make it into a kind of cup or a bowl. And there you have a vessel to eat from or drink from. And that is one of the earliest forms of making with clay. That is, you know, you can go back probably 20,000 years, and that gesture is the same. We haven't changed that much in evolutionary terms, if at all, and our hands have not changed. So when you're doing that gesture, when you're pinching a pot, you're doing this thing where you connect with that, with people 20,000 years ago. And that was always this sort of incredibly, like, spine-tinglingly exciting thing to me, that you could repeat these gestures, that there's a history in these gestures. It marks you out as an individual, because those are your gestures. They're not mine. They're not the person sat next to you. They're yours. So that clay then holds a record of you. But at the same time, it's very sort of deep and universal thing that we've been doing to sort of feed ourselves for tens of thousands of years. And that kind of ability to sort of enact these simple gestures, and kind of had this thing where it felt like it concertinaed history for me. So you could be very, very close to somebody really far away, you know, so you can kind of come together, and those hands, the way they're moving, it's so similar. But then in between you and that person, you've basically got the whole of human history, not most of it, pretty much all of it, like a lot of it. And that was just always this real kind of goosebumps sort of thing for me. And I still feel like that about it.
That's great.
Yeah.
And then there's another technique kind of like that. Well, the hand techniques using coils. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so there's a bunch of kind of hand building techniques, and it's kind of arbitrary the way we split them up in a way. You can talk about them quite generally, but often when they're actually applied, there's this kind of hybrid technique. There's some really beautiful quotes from a potter and writer called Betty Blandino about the way these techniques kind of can overlap. But there's two kind of other main hand building techniques. So coils is kind of where you have these sausages of clay, and you kind of layer them up and squidge them together. And then you can build up big pots quite quickly with that. And obviously they can take on a massive variety of forms because you're shaping them as you go. And then there's also kind of slab building, which is, where you would take big slabs of clay and kind of stick them together with liquid clay. And that is like a very broad church. You might use a mold, you might use a kind of support or a former. You might also use like it as a form of coiling. So you make kind of thick, flat snakes and then build those up into a vessel. There's so many things you can do. It is totally infinite.
Yeah. And then, of course, Jennifer, there's the wheel technique using the potter's wheel. And I found something really interesting in reading about this, that there's really some tricks to that, and it's hard to center the clay. Could you talk a bit about, what the magic of the wheel is all about?
Yeah, the magic and frustration of it, if you're a beginner, there could have been a whole book about the history of the potter's wheel, I guess. I mean, a lot of these topics, they, could be expanded into a whole book, I felt. But this one in particular, the potter's wheel is like a really a tool that hasn't changed very much. You plug it in now, it's electric, but essentially, if you go back 1,000 years, kind of the same. Like, it's not a tool that you can really soup up in any way. It does what it does. And using it, you have to do the same things. So the process of throwing is one of muscle memory, and it's one of this very like nuanced way of working with your hands and with the rotational energy that the wheel brings. And so first thing you have to do is like center the clay on the wheel. And that means you're kind of, you slap a ball of clay on the wheel head, and then what you need to do is kind of, you kind of herd it into the middle, I guess, with there is kind of set hand positions and stuff for this. But what I was trying to write it, this process of centering, like how do you describe that to somebody who's not done it before? And I was looking in all these instructional pottery books, and everyone else was like, this is really hard to describe. This is really hard to describe. Oh, it's impossible to describe this. And I realized there was this total disconnect between the expertise and knowledge of how to do that, the real knowledge of how to center a piece of clay, and the ability of our words to articulate that in a way that somebody could replicate. And it kind of really highlighted something about, that I think applies to a lot of the way we work in perhaps like craft and art and other things, that there's a forms of knowledge that are tactile or that are not verbal. And I think the wheel is like a perfect example of that, especially just because there's just this proliferation of potters saying, I just can't describe this to you. You're gonna have to work it out how to do it yourself. But there's a writer who I think was a lot better known in the US than the UK. She did a lot of teaching, and she was a potter and a poet called MC Richards, and she wrote a book called Centering that was really about this process of centering on the wheel. And she kind of extrapolated out from it that this process and the knowledge of how to do it and bringing all of that clay into the middle of the wheel. So you've not made anything yet. It's just a perfect ball on the wheel. That doing that had some spiritual value to it, or had some psychological kind of notion of centering within it. And that book, which was kind of about, it's almost like a self-help book about craft, I guess. But that book was really influential. And she was like a person who really dedicated herself to teaching. And so she became this really important person in that chapter about the wheel of how do we teach this process? How do we teach how to throw? And I came across other potters who, their teachers didn't teach them with words. They sat down next to them and imitated, put their hands on their hands, and sat with them and showed them the exact pressure, where your fingers go, how tightly you press, how to move. And it's really that interesting thing again. We come back to these gestures how that is this really nuanced form of knowledge that maybe we don't always appreciate.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion on the art and science of pottery and ceramics with the author of Clay, A Human History, Jennifer Lucy Allen. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now with my conversation with British journalist and broadcaster Jennifer Lucy Allen as we discuss her new book, Clay, A Human History.
Fire is really fundamental to the process of making ceramics, you know, and that connects for me really in a really interesting way, very poetically, about our identity as humans. You know, the discovery of fire is one of the things that we consider to be a sort of defining thing, you know, that that's what made us humans in the first place. Basically, clay, as it is in its unfired form, is infinitely recyclable. So you can dry it out, it can become really rock solid, but you can soak it again, make it workable, you can make it liquid. And that process is basically a loop that can carry on happening indefinitely, forever, absolutely eternally. And it is only with the application of fire that it becomes ceramic and that it becomes fixed in our timeline. So there's a really interesting interaction for me there between, you know, notions of kind of deep time, a more geological time, where that clay, that, you know, weathered geological material is something that is has this kind of long eternal life. And it is only when we apply fire, this very sort of, you know, human invention, if you like, only when we apply that does this thing get drawn in and fixed into our human timeline, a much shorter timeline. Although fired clay will still last, you know, maybe 10, 20,000 years into the future if you treat it right. And that sort of interaction between those timelines, the sort of symbolic way that it is fire that fixes this, these forms that we've created, felt very profound to me. And there's these beautiful sort of elements to that. So the clay turns to ceramic at 573 degrees Celsius. I'm not sure what that is in Fahrenheit, actually.
It's really hot.
It's really hot. It's not that hot. It's about twice as hot as a domestic oven.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That's hot.
But porcelain, if you have a mug in front of you, that will be fired to 1200 or 1300 degrees Celsius.
Oh. So okay, because I have one in my hands right now.
Yeah, so that was probably 1200 or 1300 degrees Celsius, but that clay that it's made from turns to ceramic at 573 degrees. So at that moment, there's this process that happens where, you know, the chemical structure of that material is changed forever, and there's no going back. No amount of water is gonna change that back to clay ever. And at that level, it'll still be a bit, it won't be the same as a mug, the mug that's in your hand. It'll still be kind of maybe friable or crumbly. But that's the moment when that ceramic change happens. And that's quite a complicated chemical process. But it is this process of, yeah, no going back.
As I understand it, there's many different levels of firing where you can have low, you know, lower heat and to higher heat levels. And I believe that there's a term for that, cones. Could you explain what that is?
Yeah, so most ceramic firing is, you can gauge it by the actual temperature. You know, you have a pyrometer in there that tells you how hot it is, usually in most kilns. But actually, the way it's better to gauge heat is by cones. And a cone is kind of a temperature range, really. So you'll have, yeah, the mug in your hand is maybe fired at something like, I would guess, depending on the mug, maybe cone seven, eight, maybe. What that cone is kind of a measure of kind of heat penetration, because what they are little, they're kind of little cones of specialist clay, and you put them in a kind of a little stand, a squidge of clay, and you watch them through a peephole, A modern electric kiln doesn't have this because they have very accurate controls. But if you're doing a wood firing or maybe a gas firing even, you will look at the cones, and when they bend over, you know, they kind of curl over, that indicates that the heat has penetrated. Because if you've got a pyrometer in there, then that is just measuring one tiny bit of the kiln. And there's often quite a lot going on in different parts of the kiln. So something at the top or something at the bottom will be quite different in the way that the heat has penetrated it.
It's amazing how there's just so much interesting physics and chemistry involved.
Mm.
Okay, another thing that struck me about this book, one of my favorite stories in here, something about it I found very interesting, were these figurines, Venuses, that were very old, from a culture that existed in Europe and was matriarchal. And I just, the story about that, just struck me as really being deeply interesting. Could you tell us a little bit about those Venus figures?
Yeah, so some of Maria Gimbutas' theories were around there being a matrilineal society around old Europe. So she read a lot into the ceramic figurines and vessels that were left from that culture, which had a huge prevalence of these really amazing Venus figurines and different kind of characters that kind of cropped up. They're really beautiful. And she sort of developed a form of archaeology which used kind of ethnographic sources to interpret what was going on. And she was quite heavily criticised for her methods. She wrote in a way that is kind of, I guess, a bit New Agey at times. And some of her theories are like very, you know, feel a bit unscholarly in a way. She'll say, this is like this, like there's no doubt, when so much about these cultures have been lost. But she was also like an incredible archaeologist. You know, she's one of the earliest female lecturers in Harvard, and moved over to UCLA when there was quite a radical department there. And sometimes her theories are misinterpreted as kind of promoting the idea of a matriarchy. And there is a little bit of that in it, but she says it's matrilineal, like, or matrifocal, because there's just not very many male figures at all. So how did she interpret this? But there isn't a written culture either, like there was in Mesopotamia. And so these figures have this absolute mystery, and there is such a developed set of, I guess, designs and forms and images that reoccur across this culture's work. And then it seems like it also was kind of fell very quickly, maybe through kind of some pretty brutal incursions or some of the stresses. But the idea that kind of grew from it, and she was writing at a time when there was kind of a lot of feminism and female spirituality kind of grasped onto her. Her theories were kind of in sync with what was going on at that time in like radical feminism. And so basically there was this, you know, there was quite a lot of drama around the theories that she was presenting, that maybe there was a society where, because they were agrarian, seemed very peaceful, there's no weapons in a lot of the archaeological digs. And so what you've got is this picture that you can paint of a society from, you know, thousands of years ago, which makes all these beautiful figurines and pottery and doesn't fight. There's no war, and is matrilineal or matrifocal in some sense. And that presented a picture of a past that was real, that showed, you know, people maybe in their 70s who were being told that the patriarchy was like the natural way of things. I think it offered people a way to say, no, here's real evidence that that doesn't have to be the case, that there's another way that we could structure society or treat each other or something. And so it became this kind of, you know, it's this almost like there's a rub, you know. We don't know how that society was structured, not really. There are these things, factors that we can't necessarily explain, but suggest certain things, like the lack of male figurines when there's so many female ones. But I found it quite, I'm not an archaeologist, I'm not interested in trying to work out whether that's real or not, whether she was right or not. And she was discredited for being, because she built this entire pantheon around these figurines, saying, you know, here's, and there was kind of animal elements in it, and they all represented different things. She kind of extrapolated a lot of detail that does feel pretty unscholarly when you read it, and she was pretty much discredited for it. But she was just used to say, I speak more languages, I have done more reading, I know this is the case. And she was really sure about it, and I found that interesting as well. She was just like, I know this. Like, it's kind of, it was so bold and curious. And I thought, what I'm really interested in as a writer is, what ideas was she presenting from this archaeological work, and why, how are we dealing with them? And why did people feel so maybe angry about them, or other people felt incredibly inspired by them? Like there was this possible future that, you know, the world could be otherwise. And some people felt their worldview was threatened by these findings that she had. And I found that kind of sort of little cultural history of those Venus figurines so interesting. And it's something that I really want to think about a bit more, I think.
Yeah, and it's just so interesting, all of that coming from these figurines from the past that, you know, when it comes right down to it, you know, there's a lot of mystery. And anytime you're dealing with artifacts that are that old that you don't exactly know the full story of. Okay, let's move on to another thing I found interesting, because I never considered, is that to have, you know, pottery, you have to have clay, you have to have clay minerals in your soil. So some places are good for that and some places not so good. And I never thought about this, but you know, definitely pointed me in the right direction here, is that there are many pottery towns around the world where, you know, their location is essential because that's where that clay comes from.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something really, we think we're in the midst of globalization, that everything is kind of flattened now. And actually, you know, factory-made ceramics are part of that. But also it's very easy to step out of it. As soon as you start making things with ceramic, you are tied to usually the country you're in, you know. So I wouldn't, here in the UK, if I buy some clay from the supplier, that's going to be from the UK. I could probably import some from Europe, maybe, but I wouldn't ever be importing it from the US, let's say. So already there, I'm sort of tied to my place in a much more general way than somebody, I guess, like 200 years ago would have been. But it's still, there's still something that's locked in there. And I find that really interesting about how clay, as soon as you start making with it, you start getting a little bit tied to your place if you want to be. It's really easy to do that. And that is like part of, I guess, the history of clay and the way that our relationship to it, in an economic sense as well, has helped trade develop in certain places, you know, like Stoke-on-Trent in the UK, various places in Japan. They're called the sort of six ancient kilns, these ancient sort of pottery making sites. And I went to Rakira in Colombia, and you know, everywhere every country has at least one, if not more, kind of pottery towns or cities, I guess.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of like winemaking. Like you have winemaking regions around the world, and there's pottery regions around the world because of the clays that are sourced there.
Yeah, and the parallel way to wine, then the clay has certain things that are unique to that place. So it might have certain minerals in it that mean it behaves in a certain way. You know, maybe it's got a lot of iron in it, which might give it a fleck or might give it some colour. Like the colour of the clay, its texture, its properties, all of these things are different in all of these sources of clay. And so, you know, when you're choosing clay to work with, if you're able to choose it from your local environment, you're so tied to that place. And it's written in the pot, in its colour, in its texture, in its surface detail. I think that's so amazing.
Do you have a favourite clay? Or is that one of those questions like asking you to name your favourite kid?
No, actually, I was on a panel, or I was moderating a panel recently, with a bunch of potters in the UK who do the throwdown, the kind of pottery version of the British Baking Show.
Oh, okay.
And somebody said, "What's your favorite clay?" And they all were like, knew what it was instantly. And I was like, "What is my favorite clay?" I have a really short attention span, so I'm always like moving between different things or trying different
What's
things.
your clay of the moment?
I use a combination of this flecked kind of creamy stoneware with a smooth black clay called Vulcan Extra Smooth, and they have similar shrinkage rates, so you can use them together. So I'll like make a mug that has a body in the flecked clay and then a handle made of the black clay. So I'm kind of combining things like that, and that also allows me to have some kind of, I guess, monochrome designs without glazing, which in when I was making at home during lockdown, glazing's like really complicated and quite toxic when you're making glazes, and it's quite a arduous thing to test out new glazes, and I'd move studios and the temperatures were different. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna find a way to make sort of color and pattern with clay, not glazes.
After a short break, we'll be back with more of our guest, British journalist and broadcaster Jennifer Lucy Allen, as we discuss her new book, Clay, A Human History. I'm Dave Schlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now with our discussion on the art and science of pottery and ceramics with our guest, Jennifer Lucy Allen. Her new book is titled Clay, A Human History.
I'd read about a really amazing potter and activist and a writer called Emmanuel Cooper in the UK. In the 1960s London, he had this little studio, but you would just go and get there was loads of building work, and you would just go and get lumps of clay from the road. You know, London's built on clay, so there'd be building works and he'd just like chip in and get a bucket's worth of clay and do what he could with that. And I was like, okay, I'm in London, yeah, where can I get some clay then? So, but my back garden is like a tiny kind of yard that's all paved over. And I'm pretty sure underneath is like a collapsed air raid shelter. So there's no clay under there, or not unless I went down very, very far. But then the neighbours across the road were having some sort of house extension. And I came back from the pub one night, and there was this skip, like a dumpster full of what I was like, oh, because I'd been watching this dumpster and I was like, okay, there's the paving, there's the scree, there's the topsoil. Next, we're going to get the clay. So I've been watching these like little dumpsters kind of fill up and get emptied again. I came back from the pub and was like, oh, here we go. And there was all this kind of orange, gritty, sticky stuff there. And I was like, this is clay. I'm pretty sure it's clay. And there's a test you can do to see if it's clay. And a lot of the way we test clay or have done historically is actually about its behavior. It's not really, nobody's doing like chemical analysis on it. And what you do is you test the little pinch part. So you get a fist and you shove your thumb in, or you roll a little sausage and wrap it around your finger. And if it holds, it's probably clay and it's good enough to use. I did come to use it, and it didn't work at all. I think it had too much sand in it, so it's really crumbly.
Oh,
I had this big bucket of clay. I was like, oh, my dreams. It just didn't work. I was really gutted.
yeah.
I thought I'd like found this like super urban, you know, free clay source. So I had to like sneak back over the road and like dump this bucket of clay in the neighbor's dumpster. But then I have some friends who are down in Cornwall, kind of on the in right in the south of England. And sort of near them, there's a kind of really small tributary of a bigger river. And they were like, I went to visit them and they were like, Jen, we think we found some clay. It's kind of all covered over with branches and trees. And I was like, oh, we'll do it later. And they were like, no, let's do it now. And we got a plastic bag and kind of like swung our way like on the trees through this little stream to the edge of this field where the stream just kind of is about a meter wide and cuts through. But the bank there was like this perfect grey clay, like slate bed, but this perfect grey clay. And I sort of remember just, you know, I'm stood there with the water, this clear water like rushing over my wellies, and pulled a fistful from the bank and just made a pot, just stood there in the stream, you know, just a little pinch pot. And then we kind of dried it out. And just, I was like, let's just bake it in your, they have an outdoor wood burner. And I knew it wouldn't get hot enough. I was pretty sure it wouldn't get to 573 degrees because there's so much heat being lost from those sorts of burners. But we put it in anyway, and it kind of was solid. It was held together. I don't think you could, you know, wash it up or anything. But it worked, and it was amazing. And it kind of went this beautiful, like, toasted orange after. And that experience of pulling it from the banks and just making something and then shoving it in the wood burner a few days later was so immediate. And it was really nice to leave them with something that was like, this is from where you live. There's nothing about it that has anything from anywhere else in. And there's something really beautiful about that, which we do kind of lose a bit with our like plastic bags of clay. But I you know, it's that's quite a seasonal thing to do. And traditionally pottery was seasonal, you know. You'd be outside and you do a lot of that work in the spring and summer. So I'm due to visit them again and go and dig some more clay out of this little riverbank.
Well, you mentioned glazing a bit ago, and I had never really thought about this before reading your book, but there was a woman that I read about in your book, and I hope I pronounce her name right, Nirmala Patwardhan.
Yeah, she was amazing.
Yeah, from India. And yeah. And the colors that she worked with. Could you just talk a little bit about what's that process all about of glazing and putting color into it?
Yeah, so glazing is, in terms of the chemistry, it's very intense. It's kind of a combination of chemistry and alchemy because it can be so unpredictable. There's so many variables. So what's happening there is you to glaze something, you do a first fire in, where you turn the clay object into ceramic, and then you put the glaze on and then fire it again. And that glaze basically turns to glass. And that's what, you know, is on all of your dinnerware that you've got at home, for example. And the colours generally come from oxides, but the way those oxides appear in those different glazes has a lot to do with the chemistry of whatever they're kind of coddled in. But the Nirmala was a potter who came over to the UK and trained with a bunch of different people here, but she was a really, really talented glaze chemist. And she developed a bunch of glazes for Ray Finch at Winchcombe and for a college here called Farnham and for Bernard Leach, who's a very famous potter. And then she went back to India to start her own pottery business. But she had this incredible talent for glazes. And while she was at Winchcombe, she was kind of a apprentice there, lived in a little caravan on site. And Ray Finch, who was there, would sort of say, oh, I want this kind of glaze or I want that kind of glaze. And she spent all this time developing them. But she was experimenting with what you could put in these glazes and kind of accidentally, apparently, developed a Chun Blue, which is it's a very ancient but quite high-tech glaze in some ways because it has materials in it that come from basically burning bones. And she'd been kind of putting bones from her dinner in the fire and then using the ashes in the glaze. And that had brought out this. Chun has this incredible kind of like milky, translucent blue kind of colour. It's really magical. There's something about it, the way it refracts the light. And this came out of the kiln, and Ray apparently saw it and like took her immediately to the British Museum, to the Chinese pottery room, and was like, got this pot out of his bag and was like, what's that in the vitrine? And she was like, oh, that's Chun Blue. And then he got it out of his bag and was like, what's this? And this is your Chun Blue. You've made it. So, you know, she was super talented and was really amazing at that experimentation. And what she did in India was, so Bernard Leach's Potter's Book, which is kind of this Bible for potters and has been for a long time, she kind of wanted to convert that for Indian potters. So place comes into this again. So, you know, Leach would have had, there's a lot of glaze recipes And she kind of converted that for what was available to Indian potters at the time. You know, really changed all of the, you know, weights and measurements, and based on what was available, because not all the same materials are available in every different place, basically. I got really interested in her because she really made me think about what it means to be the designer of a glaze, because it's such a technical process. You know, sometimes you put something in the kiln that you think is going to come out green and it comes out red. It's that level, if you're making your own glazes sometimes. And she was so amazing at this, and you know, got into the very technical aspects of it, which are just mind-boggling, you know. And I was sort of thinking about what it means to design glazes. You know, she was this author of those things, in these really high-end glazes that decorated so many people's pots, you know, Leach at Winchcombe and all these students at Farnham. But she's kind of invisible in the history because her marks on all these pots, these glazes she developed, but she's not so much in the history because her studio pottery didn't have the impact that her glazes did.
Yeah, and I also thought it was interesting, you were asking, or somebody was asking in your book about, you know, what the holy grail colors are that they'd want to make. And one of them was like Barbie pink.
Yeah, so I went to visit Mako, which is a little glaze company. And yeah, we sat down to talk about what they're able to make, what they're not able to make. And apparently, yeah, there's some colors that are really hard to make. You know, a really bright acid yellow is really hard to make. A proper poppy red is really hard to make. And apparently a Barbie pink is hard to make. Nobody knows to do it yet.
That's funny. Okay, and another thing that struck me with my interests, my personal interests, that I was not expecting to run across in a book about clay and the earth, was that there you found a source of clay off planet.
Yes.
That, you were interested in Martian clay. Tell us just a little bit about that.
Well, this was a surprise to me as well, because I think I went to Google. I was just like, I'm just checking what the moon is made of. You know, is this relevant? You know, just idly fact checking. I know the answer to this. You know, is there any clay on the moon? No, there is clay on Mars. And I was like, what? Hang on a minute. What do you mean there's clay on Mars? Like, the fact totally blew my mind, and I went looking for somebody to explain it to me, basically, and went to speak to a really incredible geochemist at the Natural History Museum in London called Javier Quadros, who was just such an amazing help for this chapter, because it's so technical, that the knowledge that is behind that fact, basically. And he helped me put it all into layman's terms. Basically, that, you know, this kind of search for life on Mars, clay is kind of a part of it, because if there's clay, that means there was weather, and weather, it means there was water, probably. How much water, we don't really know, but water means life. So if you've got clay on Mars, it kind of opens up that possibility for finding kind of the remnants of life. And that was like a real just kind of mind-blowing, like, what? Really? You know, you might as well have said there's little green men for me. Like, it just totally blew my mind. And it's one of the favourite facts that I found out on the whole book. I still tell it to people all the time. But what I really got interested in was thinking about what that means for how we might live off planet. Like, I don't want to go to Mars. I don't want to go to space, which is a whole other essay in and of itself. But if we do, like, you know, that kind of idea of like how there are these glass and metal buildings and structures, the way we live with all this kind of, you know, plastic stuff in sci-fi films and things, you can just like, all of that goes up in a puff of smoke because you've got clay on Mars. So you're making your pottery there, you know, and you're decorating it. So all of a sudden, the whole aesthetics of the kind of program to live off planet had changed. And that was like really eye-opening to me. And it's a really fun thing to let your imagination run away with. Okay, you've got clay on Mars. What are you going to make? You know, are you making Venus figurines for yourself? Are you making crockery for you to eat off? Are you decorating the walls of wherever you're living? You know, everything changes. It's amazing.
Yes, making Venus figurines on Mars, you're kind of covering all the planetary bases there. Mm. Well, Jennifer, before we let you go, you're such an interesting person with all these diverse fascinating things that you've pursued, from foghorns to ceramics and pottery. What's on the horizon for you?
I'm in the process of doing some early research on the next book. I love writing books, so I do. Yeah, there's definitely more. I've got more books in me, I think, and I am really interested in the Venus figurines. But we'll see how far we get. And then I've just got my normal, you know, BBC Radio 3 show, which is kind of the fringes of music. The idea of the show is that you are going to hear something that you haven't heard before and you might like it. So I do that regularly. And then I also just got music journalism and a bunch of other stuff coming up.
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed Clay, A Human History. It was a lot of fun, and I highly recommend it to anybody who's interested in pottery, ceramics. It's just a fun read. You could just randomly open it and you're going to find some really interesting story from somewhere in the world and somewhere in time. So thanks for sharing your passion for the subject. And it was really nice to talk to you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for all your thoughtful questions. It's so nice to talk about this stuff. It makes me excited all over again.
Thanks again to our guest, Jennifer Lucy Allen. Her new book, Clay, A Human History, is published by Pegasus Books and is available from most major booksellers, or order it at your local community bookseller. And a very special thank you to producer Matt Fidler's wife, Jill. Jill's an avid worker of clay and gave me a few deeply appreciated pointers on what it's like to make something like the cool cup she gave me that holds my morning coffee. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.